This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In March of 2008, 17-year-old Daryl Turner died of cardiac arrest after being shocked with a taser by a Charlotte-Mecklenburg police officer. Turner was unarmed, but police described him as agitated. The officer who tased Turner for 37 seconds was suspended for 5 days and required to undergo more training. Last month, a Charlotte jury ordered the company that makes tasers to pay $10 million to Turner's family. The very next day, another Charlotte man died after being tased by police. That's when the department suspended taser use for more than a month. As Law and Order Week continues, we're talking about tasers, police use of force, and civil liberties. Joining me in the studio is Katie Parker, legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina. Welcome back, Katie. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank. Thank you.
And on the phone is Sam Walker, emeritus professor of criminal justice at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. His books include The New World of Police Accountability and The Police in America. That's the leading textbook on the subject. Sam, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Katie Parker, let me ask you, in 2008, the ACLU of North Carolina started something called the Taser Safety Project. What prompted that?
Well, we had gotten a lot of complaints and heard a lot of stories of people being tased by law enforcement, and it seemed to be increasing, and we had also heard about several deaths, even just in North Carolina. I think the number at this point is over 300 deaths around the country, at least since 2000. And in North Carolina, by 2008, we had heard of approximately six, and it may have been closer to 10. And so we started wondering, well, do the sheriff's offices and police departments have policies in place to govern how these weapons are being used, and actually went first of all to the North Carolina Sheriff's Association to see if there was a model policy that could be applied throughout the state, and there wasn't. And we actually organized this safety project with a lot of different organizations and went and asked the Sheriff's Association to craft a model policy, and the Sheriff's Association refused to do so. And at that point, we sent out public records requests to all of the 100 county sheriffs and the largest 25 police departments to see what kind of policies departments had in place.
And this policy question is very important because, as you point out, your 2008 report, as of that report, there were 10 deaths reported in North Carolina, two more since then that we know of. Those are the deaths. But there are some other cases, examples, that suggest there really isn't a policy in place or that the policies aren't widely understood. I wonder if you could give us some examples. And I know that you were involved in a case in Elon, North Carolina, for instance.
We were. The ACLU of North Carolina represented a man named John Paler, who's a grandfather, who had gotten into a verbal altercation with an officer from the Elon Police Department on one day. And then the next day, the officer, who was clearly angry at Mr. Paler, came to arrest him for reckless driving, even though there had never been an arrest for reckless driving. Serving a warrant and going to someone's house a day later for reckless driving. Officer Dunn, who was the officer who had gotten into the verbal altercation with our client, was the person who clearly wanted to serve the arrest. He had told other officers, "I'm going to get him later." Went to Mr. Paler's home with his taser drawn, and within a minute of knocking on the door, Mr. Paler came out in his underwear, and Officer Dunn said, "We're here to arrest you." And Mr. Paler said, "For what?" And Officer Dunn said, "Come on, or I'm going to shoot you." Mr. Paler didn't know whether he was talking about a gun, and said, "What are you talking about?" And they tased him. And then Mr. Paler fell off his steps, and then they tased him again. And so we filed a lawsuit on Mr. Paler's behalf and ended up settling with the Elon Police Department. And out of that got a better policy for Elon, and some other departments have changed their policy as a result of that.
Sam Walker, give us a bit of history. When and why did tasers become part of the police toolkit?
Well, beginning in the late 60s or middle 60s, there was a lot of concern about police officers' use of deadly force, using their guns. and a number of new technologies developed, things like pepper spray and so on, to as an alternative when there is someone who is out of control. Tasers are simply one aspect of that. In the case of taser, there are just a lot of unanswered questions about, you know, their safety, about their impact on particular categories of people, medical conditions, medication, and so on. Meanwhile, with regard to guns and deadly force, we began to make a lot of progress, partly because of lawsuits such as we've already heard about and protests, court cases. So with firearms, there has developed a national consensus that they should be strictly limited to cases where there's a threat to somebody's life.
Sam, actually, I'm going to stop you right there because it may come as a surprise to many of us that say within our lifetime, that was not the case. And there really weren't policies governing or strict policies governing the use of weapons by police officers.
That is true. By, say, 1970, even, most police officers in this country were given a handgun as part of their tools of their job, and sent out on the street with no guidance as to when and under what circumstances they should use them. And so there were a number of cases where you had unarmed 14-year-old kids who were fleeing, who were shot in the back and killed. Now, as a result of that, and because of protests, lawsuits and such, we now have most big departments have, you know, fairly strict policies with some variation. What happened with tasers? This new product came along, aggressively marketed by, you know, Taser International, and unfortunately, you know, most departments did not surround that tool with similar policies, clearly guiding officers as to what limited range of circumstances they should be used.
And of course, those policies would in some way take into account the actual risks involved in using these, and they're marketed as something that's very safe, in fact, a non-lethal weapon. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, in the field of law enforcement, the term non-lethal has actually, you know, begun to disappear, and the accepted term is less lethal, because they are potentially lethal.
Right.
They can kill. People do die. And so that has been recognized. Many departments now have, you know, very restrictive policies indicating when a taser can be used. And probably the best general term would be to say there's some aggressive resistance by this subject and where that poses a risk to, the officer or somebody else. So you can't use it just, let's say, passive resistance. Somebody goes into the fetal position. Or where somebody has not yet really indicated any threat or completely out of control behavior.
So, Katie, what are the results of your report? It came out in 2008. You've had these examples. There have been lawsuits. Are you finding more openness now on the part of law enforcement agencies in North Carolina to developing policies?
We are. And, in fact, I was just contacted last week by a sheriff who emailed me to say we are looking to revise our taser policy and we would appreciate it if the ACLU could review it and tell us if there are areas where we should revise it. And I think that that's a positive step. I also think from a more maybe practical, cynical point of view, the police departments and the sheriff's offices are probably understanding that they are going to be subject to liability if they don't have policies in place. The law on tasers has changed dramatically since 2008. There are cases in almost every federal circuit that hold that improper taser use can lead to a court finding unreasonable seizure and excessive force. And so sheriffs and police chiefs should know that if they don't have policies in place that rein in bad actors on their force that the department itself could be held liable.
It's interesting that the $10 million lawsuit in Charlotte was against Taser International, the company. In other words, they suggested that the company itself didn't inform police departments about the lethal capability of these. I mean, that's not the same as saying a policy that suggests when and how to use these weapons.
Well, it's true, Frank, and one thing that's also interesting is that it's clear that Taser International seems to be putting it right back on the police departments, and that's something that police chiefs and sheriffs should note, too, is that it's clear that Taser International is going to start, their defense is going to be, well, the police departments didn't use the weapon properly. So that's should be of concern to police chiefs.
What was your reaction to that lawsuit? Was it helpful in getting policy change, do you think?
I believe that it was and it will be, and I wonder, the sheriff who contacted me, I can only speculate, but I'm guessing that part of that was because of the verdict.
Sam, what about you? What's your reaction to that jury award?
Well, you know, people all around the country complain about, you know, lawsuits. You know, we have too many lawsuits, and it ties everything up in the courts, and it restricts government agencies and public corporations, private corporations, and so on. The fact is that because agencies, law enforcement agencies, and other organizations fail to act responsibly, litigation becomes one of the most effective tools for achieving accountability.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about tasers and policing with Katie Parker of the ACLU of North Carolina, Sam Walker, Emeritus Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Just ahead, our conversation continues when we get the view of a former police chief, in fact, the former chief of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Will join us on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about tasers and evolving police tactics and accountability. Amnesty International says tasers contributed to more than 350 deaths in the U.S. between 2001 and 2008. The website Truth Not Tasers claims 42 Americans have died so far this year after being tased. Katie Parker is legal director of the ACLU of North Carolina. She's in the studio with me. On the phone is Sam Walker, emeritus professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He's the author of several books on policing and accountability. And joining us now from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte is Daryl Stevens. He was chief of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police from 1999 to 2008. He's now on the faculty of the Public Safety Leadership Program at Johns Hopkins University. Chief Stevens, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You were chief in Charlotte when tasers were first introduced. Tell us about the decision to start using them and about training and guidelines for their use what was in effect then and maybe how they've changed.
Well, as Sam Walker had mentioned earlier, there's been a search for a number of years for less lethal weaponry that police officers could use that would minimize injuries to individuals who were resisting arrest and to the officers who had to physically take them in custody. There's been a number of them. Pepper spray came along in the mid-80s, widely adopted by police departments, and tasers were another alternative that began to be introduced and became widely used around 2002, 2003, somewhere in that neighborhood. Like other large agencies, we were looking for something that would help deal with difficult situations and people resisting police officers in the hopes that it would contribute to fewer injuries and deaths on the part of individuals that police encountered as well as the police officers. So we tested them in the field for about 6 months, then felt like that it would be a tool that would be helpful to us and began to put them in place. Had a very restrictive policy that governed their use. They don't get used very often in Charlotte and in many other places. And then over the years, for example, in 2005 or 2006, a group called the Police Executive Research Forum engaged in some national surveys and work and looking at policies and how they developed a model policy that our department was involved in working on. And we made a couple of adjustments in our policy at that time, but ours was restricted to aggressive action on the part of resistance on the part of an individual, not merely disobeying a verbal command.
What would you say would be the ideal policy then? When should they be used and when should they not be used?
They should be used as when people are engaged in active resistance. If there's an officer has advised somebody that they're under arrest, told them what the charge is, and they aggressively take steps to avoid that arrest, that's the circumstance under which they should be used. I know in Charlotte and in many other places, once they were put in place, fully adopted throughout the department, the injuries of people that resisted arrest as well as officers declined significantly. Charlotte and other communities have had a number of cases that where deadly force could have been used, and there was an opportunity that a taser was deployed, and we think there's a significant number of lives that are being saved because of the use of this type of technology.
So it's interesting, Sam Walker. Let me put this question to you. On the one hand, it's attractive to think of a weapon that is non-lethal most of the time, less lethal certainly than a gun, used in a situation when a gun might be used, lives could be saved, injuries could be reduced. But the question is that the only time the taser is used, or are they being used in situations when a gun never would have been used, or a baton might not have been used, because the officer sees it as a non-lethal alternative? Sam?
There are some departments, and there's evidence where the departments do not have effective policies and do not have effective supervision, where the taser has become an add-on. They're instead of using it as a substitute for a firearm or a baton, they're using those at the same rate, then adding on using the tasers for that. And so that's a very bad situation. And so there are you know, sort of different responsibilities here. Taser, as in with this lawsuit, has a responsibility to inform people who buy their product what the risks are. Departments who do, you know, decide to purchase tasers and deploy them have a responsibility to have a very clear and restrictive policy.
Katie,
it does happen that, and it was happening here in Omaha at our police department. The number of you know serious force incidents went up because they were using it for low level incidents when they wouldn't have used either a baton or a gun.
And Katie Parker, your report also cites cases in which young people who are not adults, children, are being tased.
That's right. And one of the things that our report focused on were vulnerable populations. Many policies do have provisions in place that prevent or limit use of tasers against children, against elderly, against visibly pregnant women, against people who are on an elevated surface, because oftentimes people can fall and then get a secondary injury. But many departments don't have policies that limit that type of use. Another thing that I think is interesting and disturbing about taser use is there's a way to use a taser that's drive stun mode, and it's been touted, including by Taser International, as a way to effect pain compliance. So it has not.
So what is drive stun mode and what is pain compliance? I need to know what those two things.
So the taser can be used in two different ways. You can shoot probes, and that's the way it's used often if the officer is at risk or someone else is at risk. And as we said in our report, and we continue to state that the ACLU of North Carolina feels that that's an appropriate use of a taser. If someone is at risk and that is a way to prevent injury for the safety of the officer or others, that makes sense. But there's another way to use the taser. If you're close enough, you can use it and force it into someone's body. And it was actually has been touted by Taser International as a form of pain compliance, saying, I don't like that if I'm an officer and you're not complying with an order, so I'm going to make this very painful for you. And even PERF, referenced by Chief Stevens, the Police Executive Research Forum, has said don't use tasers in drive stun mode for pain compliance. So that's something that's of real concern.
Daryl Stevens, I suppose we should step back a second and describe how these work, just what's going on with the weapon. It can be used at a distance. It can also be used at point blank. Tell us how they work.
Whether you use it, whether you fire the projectiles out, there's two projectiles that or one projectile that comes out with two prongs in it. And they're like little hooks. And they, when they strike you, both of them have to strike you. When they strike you, they give you this electrical shock. And the electrical shock normally causes most people to stop doing whatever they're doing at the time. And so officers are able to gain control and handcuff the person. The drive stun that was mentioned is when you're in very close proximity. In fact, you may be on the ground wrestling with someone. That's where you can place the front of the taser on the individual itself and depress the trigger, and it gives you that that shock. It's a much narrower arc because it's the width of the prongs inside of the in the weapon and not spread out. But the policies require the same kind of aggressive resistance before it's actually deployed.
Did you have a sense when you first started using tasers that the company fully explained to you all of the risks and protocols that should be used when you're going to use a taser?
We had and continue to have a very high quality training staff and training program. We paid very close attention to use of force policy, both deadly force, less lethal force, any kinds of force, and we engaged in significant training. We felt that the risk, the value that the taser brought to the department as a less lethal weapon was something that would be good for our community and good for the officers and provided them a tool to deal with these situations that would minimize their injuries. So we made a conscious decision that with good quality training, good policy, that they could be safely used as an effective tool on the street.
Sam, there was a big report out this year from the National Institute for Justice that found that tasers did significantly reduce injuries to suspects and officers because most injuries result from batons or hand-to-hand scuffles. Now, do we know how many, the numbers on the deaths in police custody, that if whether or not they've changed just in the aggregate with the introduction of tasers?
I'm not sure we have the best data on that. Let me say about the Justice Department report on tasers. The evidence does indicate that it can reduce injuries to citizens, and it can reduce injuries to officers, and that's all to the good. And I think that's when tasers are used properly. The problem is that tasers is a very complex technology. It's not a billy club, which is pretty simple technology, and there are still some unanswered questions as to the impact on people in certain circumstances. Their health, medication, and so on. And so we really need more scientific research to specify that. It might happen that in the end the risks will be too great and not worth the savings that are the beneficial aspects that we're now aware of. So there's simply a lot more research and policy thinking that needs to go on with tasers.
Daryl Stevens, there are cases, lethal or not, in which the use of tasers just seems clearly out of line. I think there was an 80-year-old woman tased in a hospital bed. There was a mentally ill man standing on a ledge. He was tased, fell to his death. the Elon case that Katie was talking about. And I'm sure that you would agree that these are all cases that were inappropriate. But what do you think explains this? Is it a kind of an attitude about this thing as a non-lethal weapon? It can be used, you know, more arbitrarily or more easily? Is it just rogue officers? What do you think explains these cases?
I think it's difficult to explain the use in some circumstances that we've seen widely reported around the country. And on the surface, clearly you have lots of questions about why it would be deployed under those circumstances. Sometimes you have police officers who just violate policy. They get involved in things, and even though they know what the policy is, they get angry or something happens to them, and they just violate policy. And in those cases, it's up to the department to hold them accountable, make sure that they understand what the policy is, and deal with them in whatever way is necessary. Sometimes police officers make mistakes, honest, legitimate errors in judgment. They should be held accountable. They should be retrained. They should have the opportunity to understand, you know, the impact of that mistake what it has caused both them and the person that they or the people they may have encountered on the street. So you've got a range of situations there. For those that just violate the policy intentionally, they should be dealt with straightforward and in a harsh way. Those who make legitimate mistakes, that should be treated differently. And so it's not. I don't think you can put a label on police officers in general. They're all humans. They're all out there trying to do their work in the best way that they've been trained and understand how to do it. But some of them just do things that they ought not to do.
Can I jump in on that point?
Sure, Sam.
Well, Darrell Stevens is being a little overly modest. He is the author of a recent report, Police Discipline, A Case for Change. Emerged out of Harvard University, and it's published by the National Institute of Justice. It is simply the best single piece on the disciplinary process that is available. It's 25 pages. Everybody should read it. Every police chief, every sheriff ought to read that. It talks about the problems with disciplinary procedures that departments have, and has a set of recommendations for change. And so if those changes were made, and every chief can start this, you know, this afternoon working on this, it would go a long way towards sending a message to those officers who might be prone to either using a taser improperly or using their fists improperly to really correct their behavior. And so I really recommend that report. It's available conveniently on the web. Police Discipline, A Case for Change.
Should the guidelines on tasers themselves – Darrell, were you going to say something?
My thanks to Sam. He's very kind.
I'll let you get that that moment of hospitality into the program. Katie, should these guidelines on tasers themselves – do we need national guidelines on these?
I think it would be very helpful. I mean, and helpful for officers and for police chiefs and sheriffs. You know, there's a lot that's not known, and that's something that we found when we were doing the project. I mean, I think most officers and most police chiefs and sheriffs want to do the right thing. They may not be aware of some of the risks. And to be honest, they're certainly not going to get that information from Taser International. And Taser International does a lot of the training, and that's the only training done for many departments, which is of concern. For instance, there's real concern, and there was concern in the Charlotte case about continuous firing. Daryl Turner was shot by a Taser for, I think it was 37 seconds. And, you know, there's an awareness that needs to be there for officers that, hey, these are potentially deadly weapons, and if you have to use it, and I'm not saying that the officer had to in that situation, but if you do have to use it, there are ways to use it that are more safe than others.
Are we convinced that these are – I mean, we are certainly convinced in this conversation. I think everybody who's taken part in this conversation has said they are potentially lethal weapons. Is there an argument out there? Are there those police officials, Taser International themselves, who would argue that it is not potentially lethal?
This is – I don't believe that there's many police officials, at least those that I talk to, that do not understand that it's a less lethal weapon. And they then do their training and develop their policies accordingly.
Is there any change, a technological change? Do tasers need to change the way they're built in order to become safer? Could they be? Daryl, I'll put the question to you first.
Well, I think there is one the continuous fire. The first models of Taser had a 5-second the shock. You would deploy the trigger, it would go 5 seconds, and then you would have to pull the trigger again. The later model did not have that, and I think a lot of people felt like that it continued to have that, but the 5-second burst and then having to re-pull the trigger may avoid some of the difficulties that they've had with their deployment.
Is there a competing model? Is there something that in any way competes with the Taser and Taser International?
There's a there's a model that was introduced probably 5 years ago or so. It's called a Stinger. It's one that is a similar technology, and it's been on the market, but it has not been widely adopted.
We're going to take a break right now. My guest this hour, Daryl Stevens, former police chief at Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, Sam Walker, emeritus professor of criminal justice at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and Katie Parker is with the ACLU of North Carolina. Coming up, how law enforcement has changed in recent years, especially in light of the war on terror. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour about policing, accountability, and civil liberties. Katie Parker, legal director of the ACLU of North Carolina, is with me in the studio. On the phone is Sam Walker, emeritus professor of criminal justice at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Daryl Stevens is former chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. He's with us from WFAE Studios in Charlotte. And joining us now on the phone is David Cole. He's a professor of law at Georgetown University. David's also the author of The Torture Memos, Rationalizing the Unthinkable and Less Safe, Less Free, Why We Are Losing the War on Terrorism. And those are both from the New Press. David, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, coming up on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, law enforcement agencies were given the mandate, first and foremost, to prevent terrorism. In broad terms, what effect do you think that's had?
Well, I think it's essentially caused both the federal law enforcement officials and local law enforcement offices to shift to a much more aggressive and preemptive approach to terrorism. So the notion is we need to catch the terrorists before they act. The problem is we can't predict the future. And so what you see when the government is driven to this kind of preventive approach is the use of very broad, sweeping measures to round up the usual suspects, often rounding up people who actually turn out to have nothing to do with terrorism. You also see aggressive use of informants that infiltrate various groups and then help to hatch plots that might well have never occurred had the informants or the provocateurs not been involved. And you see much more aggressive use of surveillance because we are seeking to find something that we can't really identify because it's in the future, and so we seek to expand surveillance. And all of those things have happened in the wake of 9/11. Just to give one example, in the first 2 years after 9/11, the federal government locked up in preventive detention over 5,000 foreign nationals in the United States in counterterrorism initiatives. Virtually all of them were Arab or Muslim. Not one of them turned out to be convicted of a terrorist offense. And some were picked up on such tips as an anonymous tip received by the FBI that there are too many Middle Easterners working at a convenience store down the street. So the FBI sends out their agents. They line up the Middle Eastern men at the convenience store. If they can't rule out that they're a terrorist, they lock them up. Then they look for some pretextual immigration charge to justify holding them. Then they investigate them. And in every case, concluded that the individuals were not, in fact, involved in terrorism and subsequently released them. But people sat in jail for anywhere from 3 days to 6 months while the FBI sought to convince itself that these people were innocent.
That's a change, of course, with federal law enforcement agencies and their approach. What about at the local level? Did things change for local police?
Well, yes, and again, it depends, you know, in some places more than others, to be sure. In cities that are potential terrorist attack targets, the changes have been the most dramatic. The NYPD has really, really ramped up its anti-terrorism efforts. There was an article in the Associated Press yesterday or the day before about the links between the NYPD and the CIA, in which the NYPD has been hiring CIA officials, and the CIA has been sending some of its current CIA officials, paid by the CIA, to go work at the NYPD. And, you know, that, of course, raises concerns about the crossing the line between the CIA, which is supposed to not be engaged in domestic law enforcement, and a domestic local law enforcement entity, the NYPD.
Chief Stevens, you were chief of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department before and after 9/11. Did you see any changes in your department and how you approach law enforcement?
Absolutely. Probably the biggest change that we've seen in local law enforcement is the ability to access information. Technological changes, databases, and connecting information from different parts of a region and in different regions in the country. We saw these fusion centers created, which are places where local and federal and state law enforcement and others such as fire and public health come together to analyze intelligence as it comes in and take whatever action is needed to deal with it. In most cases, in the big cities, these places, the fusion centers and the technology is directed towards all crimes. We believe that the contribution that the local police can make to prevention of terrorism is through our relationships and contacts and understanding of our own communities. Solid relationships with the neighborhoods and the communities help us hear about things that we wouldn't hear about otherwise. But we've created in some cities 24-hour crime analysis centers, or what they call real-time analysis centers, that does both the crimes that police deal with, but it also has the intelligence capability to help contribute to keeping America safe from terrorism.
I wonder if that change, though, in focus from crime prevention and criminal work that police do to terrorism prevention changes your relationship with the community. Is it a kind of, well, everyone is a potential terrorist?
There's no reason for that to change the relationship with the community. I think over the past 10 years or so, police do not have the same relationship that they had with the communities during the late 90s, and when community policing and problem solving was such an important part of policing. But it's terrorism prevention only has a little bit to do with that. What has more to do with it is we've seen significant declines in resources over during this time frame, with the greatest coming in the past 2 or 3 years. So some of the programs and the initiatives that had wide base support from the federal government and political folks throughout the country, they no longer have it. So the relationships have declined, not necessarily because of terrorism, because of a shift in the way we police.
Katie Parker, what has changed for you at the ACLU in the last 10 years in terms of the kinds of legal issues that you see yourself addressing?
Well, one thing that I think is interesting Frank, is one of the ways that local police are now getting into what was at least premised as terrorism prevention is now local enforcement of immigration. And there's been increased local enforcement of immigration, and part of that was the rationale was terrorism prevention. And I would agree with Chief Stevens that community policing has eroded for many reasons, but one of the ways that we've seen is that now the already limited resources of police are being used for immigration enforcement, and the immigration enforcement is against people with very minor offenses, if any, that have nothing to do with terrorism, certainly. And one of the problems is that victims and witnesses are less inclined to come to the police because they're afraid that if they do, that if they're undocumented or if their family is undocumented, that they'll get pulled into the system and deported.
Sam Walker, what effect do you think broadly the anti-terror mandate has had on law enforcement in this country?
Well, I think it's had a very bad impact, and I think Chief Stevens put his finger right on the problem. It has shifted the sort of the dominant paradigm away from the community policing paradigm, where the emphasis is on partnerships and with community groups, to this war paradigm, where just unconsciously, police officers begin thinking of the dangerous people out there as the enemy, and shifting, their mindset, and also shifting the resources of departments away from this more creative, community policing approach that I think has so much promise. Dave, I'm really very worried about this, and the fact that so much money has been available. It's just money buys a lot of things.
Right, but apparently that's diminished, and so that's just stretched the resources of police departments thin as their mandate expands. I mean, Daryl, I heard that you say that's become part of the problem. If the mandate hasn't changed, but the resources have shrunk.
They've shrunk dramatically. You see, there's very few police departments across the country that have not had flat budgets for a number of years. There's a significant number of them that have laid off police officers, or they're not hiring. Not all, but the majority find themselves in a situation where the work continues to increase. They just have to figure out how to do it with significantly fewer people.
Does it worry you, this relationship, this increasingly close relationship with, in particular, the CIA, but perhaps the FBI, working together, working to infiltrate peace groups, activist groups, that sort of thing? Is that relationship proper, Daryl Stevens?
Well, The CIA does have representatives in some of the fusion centers around the country. Not everyone, but they do have people that they're not there all the time, but they have contacts. But that doesn't lead to them infiltrating groups around the country just to go there on fishing exhibitions. The relationships with the community, at least in Charlotte, we've had a strong and continuing dialogue with our Muslim community going back before 9/11, but increasingly so following that time frame. The FBI has joined in those conversations and worked through various issues involved. Whenever your alert level would change, for example, we had strong communications with different parts of our community to help them deal with whatever fears and concerns that they have. I don't know the description of the situations that Mr. Cole describes. I'm just not familiar with what the FBI is doing in that area.
Well, Katie Parker, let me ask you if that the relationship between the CIA and the police disturbs you.
It does, and there have been documented cases around the country of infiltrations in peace groups and other groups. We've heard concerns even in North Carolina about infiltrations into mosques, and that raises a lot of different constitutional issues, including First Amendment rights to associate and free exercise of religion rights as well.
David Cole, you wrote in The Nation earlier this summer that 10 years on from 9/11, we appear to be winding down our wars abroad. One would think we might also reconsider the sacrifices that we've made of our civil liberties in that war on terror. But in fact, we seem to be ratcheting that up in terms of what we're willing to give up. David Cole?
Well, that's right. And you know, for example, when the Patriot Act was enacted shortly after 9/11, a number of the more troubling provisions of that statute were sunsetted on the notion that, well, you know, we need to respond temporarily to this problem, but we'll come back to it, and these things will sunset unless we conclude that it's important to continue them on. And every time a Patriot Act provision has come up for renewal, it's been renewed, including most recently four provisions just earlier this year. And at the same time, the attorney generals have regularly ratcheted down the constraints on the FBI in conducting terrorism investigations. John Ashcroft ratcheted down those guidelines. These guidelines were put in place in the 70s after it was shown that the FBI was using surveillance to infiltrate civil rights groups, peace groups, environmental groups, and the like. But those have been ratcheted down, first by Attorney General Ashcroft, then by Attorney General Michael Mukasey, and now it's reported that Attorney General Holder is contemplating issuing a new set of guidelines that would further free the FBI to, for example, rummage through people's trash, follow them 24 hours a day without having any credible evidence that they're involved in terrorism. Not probable cause, not reasonable suspicion. They don't have to have anything. They can just say, well, today we're going to follow this individual. We're going to attend any public event that he goes to, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think what we've seen is a kind of institutionalization of many of the sacrifices that were initially made after 9/11, at least ostensibly in a short-term basis, to the point where they are now permanent.
Well, I mean, the argument is they've worked. Why would you pull them out? They've kept us safe this long. Pulling them out only makes us vulnerable. Leave them in.
Right. Well, that's a decent argument if you can, in fact, show that they've worked, if you can show that they've helped to identify actual terrorists, disrupted actual plots. You know, if you look at the record of criminal prosecutions in the United States and in quote-unquote terrorism cases, there are very few real plots that have been disrupted. There are some, to be sure, and it's not clear that Patriot Act reforms were necessary to disrupt those. But the vast majority of the terrorism prosecutions since 9/11 have been not for engaging in terrorism, not even for planning to engage in terrorism, but for providing what they call material support to a group that's been put on a blacklist as a designated foreign terrorist organization. And under that statute, the government need not show that the support had any connection to actual terrorism that the recipient group engages in. In fact, the Supreme Court just a year or so ago said that it's okay to make it a crime to advocate for peace and human rights if you're doing so to a group that's been put on the blacklist. Even though your purpose is not to further terrorism, your purpose is to encourage the group not to use violence, to use lawful means. The Supreme Court said that can be criminally proscribed. That's a very, very broad statute, and that's where most of the terrorism cases that we've seen have been of that form, not of the form of somebody who's, you know, planning to actually blow up a building or engage in.
Well, I'm afraid we are out of time. I want to thank all of you for being on the program. David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University. Daryl Stevens, former police chief of Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Sam Walker, emeritus professor at the University of Nebraska-Omaha. And Katie Parker, legal director of the ACLU of North Carolina. Thank all of you for being on the program. And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.